This episode of Science Studio originally aired March 6th, 2011.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli, and today we have a visitor from Arizona. He's a person that specializes in geoscience and archaeology, and putting those two things together, looking at early populations, early civilizations, specifically in the southwestern Great Plains. So, who's our expert today?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Professor Vance Holliday from the Department of Anthropology and Geosciences at the University of Arizona. Welcome to Science Studio, Doc Holliday.
Thank you very much for inviting me over.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. But before we get on to the role that geology can play in archaeology, let's talk a little bit about Vance Holliday. How did you get into being a scientist? What were the driving forces, if you can remember them cogently?
I grew up in San Antonio, and I was always interested in the past. I was always interested in history as a kid. You know, we have the Alamo and all that in San Antonio. And fossils interested me. Dinosaurs interested me. Things having to do with the past. So I guess that's where it started. In college, I started out in architecture. I didn't realize at the time people actually made their living as archaeologists and paleontologists and all that. But I realized, about my second year in architecture school, that I had no sense of design. And not that that stopped a lot of people, but I realized that wasn't going to be for me. And I was watching a television show. I remember it quite vividly in the fall of 69, a show with E.G. Marshall called The Manhunters. And it was an interdisciplinary excavation at a cave site in France. And I saw that show, and it.
Well, I remember that. Lascaux, I think. The caves at Lascaux?
I don't remember. Lascaux has just got painting, as far as I know, but I don't remember. My recollection was southern France. But I realized that is what they were doing is what I wanted to do, not just archaeology, but all the other scientific aspects. I'll forever remember that show. Well, I should track it down on YouTube.
I was going to say, it would be nice to see it again and look at it in a critical, professional.
I think there was one about Lascaux that he was introducing, but, you know, it wasn't just the paintings. It was what were they eating?
Exactly.
You know, and how did they cook and all that
stuff. Climate? And so and I found out, and then in the meantime, that the University of Texas had a big archaeology program, and so I went there and...
Rest is history.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I've been.
Did your parents have any impact? I mean, not all children grow up looking at the past. I mean, okay, dinosaurs, but going beyond that to think of man's history, and would your parents sort of encourage that? Or?
They were happy for me to do whatever I wanted to do, which I appreciated. My father was sort of self-educated, but he had wide interests. My mom equally had broad interests. She had gone to the University of Texas during the Depression, and so she was well-educated. They both were well-educated. They weren't scientists, but they didn't discourage me. Let me put it that way. I can remember my mom buying me a rock hammer to help me find fossils.
They liked you to think.
Yeah, whatever I wanted to do that made me happy.
And take the hammer
and that was
outdoors.
Interested. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, literally, she bought me a rock hammer because I wanted to go collect fossils there in the hill country in central Texas because there were loads of fossils.
And you know, I also have a hobby is history, and I was reading a book. I'm still reading it. I don't remember the author, but it's called Being Texan, if you ever heard of it. And what's interesting about it, it's about 30 very short chapters starting at the very beginning. Who were the first people here? What were their towns? How did they live? It's just fascinating because you look around and you see what was happening here where all these cultures are interfacing. Amazing.
Family history was always part of growing up, and I think that was part of my interest in history. My mom was from a Czech family. She'd been in the Army. In fact, she was here at Fort Bliss during World War II as a WAC. My father was career military. So the past was there, was present, I guess.
Okay, so then how do we tie geological science, which obviously is all about past, to human past?
Yeah.
So what's the connection that you have made and specialize in?
Well, as I was doing archaeology, I finally realized that I was wondering about the dirt that contained the artifacts. That had to have a story as well. I mean, people don't exist in a vacuum. And I knew that there must be something there that we could learn. And I ended up doing a PhD in geology because I realized just picking up a couple of courses here and there wasn't going to do it. And so I just decided, well, if I'm going to find out more about soils and sediments and all that, I'll just turn in that direction for a PhD. So in the meantime, I had developed an interest. By then, I was at Texas Tech for a master's degree and working on a project, an archaeological project there that was explicitly interdisciplinary. They had geologists and soil scientists and paleobiologists at Texas Tech involved in the project. And so I was taking courses. I had the opportunity to take courses outside of the areas of interest I started out with.
So what was the project?
It's called the Lubbock Lake Project, and it's an archaeological site in Lubbock, Texas. It's still there. There's a museum, and it's part of the Texas Tech Museum. It's a fascinating archaeological site that spans basically the entire history and prehistory of Lubbock, Texas. And it's owned by Texas Tech now, and they have tours and all that.
So what did you learn from the soil?
Well, what my focus was you know, how do the different sediments that contain the archaeology, how did they get there, and what does that tell us about environmental conditions, for example? Like, there are old lake deposits, so there had to have been standing water. There were some stream deposits, so there had to have been flowing water at various times in the past. And, of course, Lubbock is a very dry landscape now, and so the environmental setting had very obviously changed over time, and people are there having to deal with these changes over time. And so we were working on trying to understand how did the environmental conditions change, when did they change.
So it used to be wet?
Oh, yeah.
And now it's dry?
Yep.
So the transformation from having Lubbock Lake to Lubbock Dry, I mean, when did that happen, and what was the civilization that was there when it was wet? And does one know where they went, for example, like the Anasazi? They just disappear.
This, we're talking about, 13,000, 12,000 years ago. There was a flowing stream through the area at about 13,000, and it evolved into a lake. So that suggested to us that it was getting drier because there's less water on the landscape, so you can't support a river. And yes, the earliest occupants of North America, basically, it's called a Clovis people, were there at that time. And Clovis is the earliest well-documented
supposedly people group. Coming across the Bering
yes,
Strait
exactly.
And moving slowly to Florida around 12,000 years ago.
Exactly, something like that. And Clovis is the first well-recognized archaeological complex, for lack of a better term, in North America. And so we have Clovis occupation at Lubbock. And so these early hunters and gatherers were there and occupied the area throughout the evolution of the site from flowing water to standing water. That was about 12,000 years ago, and continuously for some thousands of years. There's really no time when the site wasn't occupied, although I think the intensity of occupation probably changed because conditions got quite a bit warmer and drier by about, 8,000 years ago. As far as where they went, we don't know that they went anywhere. That's very difficult to get at because all we're dealing with are bones of animals that they killed, hunted and killed, and stone tools. So you see the evolution of the tool technology, but whether they went away, we can't say. What we can see is that the artifact types changed through time. Now, whether it was the same people just, you know, updating their tools, updating their styles, we see.
Did you ever run into a guy named Scotty McNeish who used to be here?
I have never met him, but he's legendary in archaeology.
Yeah, and he came into my lab one day, and he had these two sticks that were burnt. And he said, these are carbon dated, and there were either people here 30,000 years ago or there were fire-making bears. I remember that quote. And that was very controversial, but later on it was proven right that people were here earlier than the Clovis people all up and down South America and so on.
It's still controversial as far as which sites are older than Clovis and which aren't. There's a famous one in Chile, coastal Chile, Monteverde. It was the first site generally accepted by the archaeological community. There are not very many that are generally accepted. There are a lot of controversial sites. And it really depends on who you ask as to which list of sites people are willing to accept.
Yeah, but Scotty was legendary. That's right,
in
the National Academy as well. So
he was around, very active when I was starting out, but I never met him, but certainly knew who he was.
The tools that you were talking about, mm-hmm. right? I mean, different societies had the same sorts of tools. Is it always so clear that you can get an old tool that is, you know, a an arrowhead or whatever and immediately say it must belong to this particular region. I mean, the development in different parts of the world sort of was very similar. Can you tell differences between tools from one civilization to another?
Part of it depends on where you are in time, because you see more diversification in tool types, artifact styles through time. As you get more people on the landscape, you seem to see more diversification, probably because people are not moving around as much. You know, you're bumping into your neighbors. So you see more diversification in tool types through time. And then, you see evolution of technology. You get into you leave the Paleolithic, the Stone Age, and you get into the various metal cultures. And
right.
So it depends on what time period you're talking about is how distinctive particular artifact types are. But, for example, what we call Clovis points, which is really, when we say Clovis people, what we're saying is the people who made this distinctive spear point called Clovis, that is unique to North America at about 13,000 years ago, not before, not after.
So would you be able to find Clovis points of the same type of style that could look very similar in the Russian steppes?
No.
And so what is idiosyncratic about those points?
Just the way they look, just the style. They're about 6 inches long. They're, I guess, what a lot of people would think of as a classic spear point. Well made, in other words, the technology used to make them is fairly sophisticated. They have what we call a flute or a channel in the base, running about a third of the way up, that probably was for hafting and, to a shaft. And they're very distinctive. And then they're followed immediately by what's called fulsome. And fulsome points are unique. They're more localized. They're generally Great Plains artifacts, but you could find them over into the Rockies and over to the Mississippi. So east and west of the Great Plains, but they're not continent-wide. So you're already seeing some geographic.
But the Clovis points all the way go to the East Coast and Florida and so on.
Clovis points are coast to coast, yeah.
Yeah.
Probably because there's nobody else around. But Folsom is more geographically restricted. It's a little bit later, and you're seeing diversification now because there's some other styles. Folsom is more finely made. It's smaller. It's better made in terms of the technology. And one of the distinctive characteristics is this flute or channel occupies almost the entire length of the point. They're exceptionally well made. Well-crafted. They're very distinctive. And then they go away. People stopped making them about 11,000 years ago.
So from the point of view of the stone that they're made from, then you can talk about provenance. I mean, you can say, yeah, this came from Arizona.
Well,
New Mexico.
We try to.
But
not,
there was,
you can always do that.
In that book I'm talking about, this is later, maybe 2,000 years, there's a mineral deposit in northern Texas, which is unique.
Right.
And they were making points out of it. I forget the name of
Alabates.
It. Alabates.
That's a national monument, yeah.
And they were finding them in California
right.
all over, meaning that the trade was going on.
Right.
They would trade this rare mineral and to make points.
Either they're trading them or going a long way to getting them. Yeah, the Alabates is, you can find artifacts made of Alabates. It's an agate, I think, all the way to the Great Lakes. There are a number of raw materials like that are highly prized, particularly by the earliest people. So this is, what we're talking about is Paleo-Indian times, which is Clovis and Folsom and the people that are around when there are big now extinct animals, they went after the really high quality raw materials. You don't see that again. For whatever reason, after Paleo-Indian times, that's one of the characteristics. Exceptionally well-made artifacts using really top quality raw materials.
If you were hunting a mammoth, you better have the right tips.
Yeah, Clovis points is what you usually find. And Alabates is one of the best examples of that. Yeah.
You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and Dr. Vance Holliday from the University of Arizona. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. With the advancement of biomedical science, you may find it hard to believe that we're only able to grow less than 1% of all bacteria.
That's a big problem because growing and studying bacteria is one way we discover new antibiotics. And finding new antibiotics is vital if we're going to save millions who will die from drug-resistant bacteria.
Scientists study microbes to learn how they defend themselves. Bacteria secrete compounds that allow them to outcompete other microbes. But if we can't grow the billions of bacteria in the environment, how are we to harness their potential?
Here's where a new device is offering a game-changing solution, the iChip. A hard piece of plastic with 192 tiny wells. researchers dipped the I-chip in a bacterial sample mixed with agar to trap one in each well.
The I-chip is placed into a larger sample from the bacteria's natural environment, for example, the soil. That's the key. These microbes are able to grow in their own environment, which then allows us to observe how they behave.
Researchers were able to grow never-before-cultivated microbes from a wide range of sources, including wastewater, saliva, marshes, and mud. Remarkably, an I-chip grown in the soil from a field in Maine yielded a new class of antibiotics called Tyxobactin.
The antibiotic looks promising because of its unique ability to thwart antibiotic resistance. Since many of our antibiotics come from studying bacteria, imagine the possibilities of this technology.
Scientists believe I-chip will have applications beyond medicine as we find novel chemicals, new energy sources, and even technologies we haven't even thought of.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Vance Holliday from the Department of Anthropology and Geosciences, University of Arizona. We're talking about old civilizations. Well, specifically, older civilizations in the Southwest and the Great Plains of the U.S. I just want, before we leave alone, this business of the points and the arrows, spearheads. What was the technology they used? Did they have a harder stone to be able to chop up the agates into the spears? Do we know exactly how they did this?
We think we know because there's a lot of archaeologists who specialize in this and have reproduced these artifacts. It's fairly elaborate. These are different kinds of chert. Agate is a kind of chert, or flint, I guess is a term a lot of people would know. And they would start off using harder stones like quartzite or something, whatever was available, and would rough them out using the harder stones. But for the fine tuning, the real fine work, they would use probably wood or antler to do the very fine chipping that's necessary to shape the artifacts. Because you have to do very careful, very fine. When I say fine, you're taking off chips or flakes that are maybe a quarter of an inch. And you do that using, it's called pressure flaking. And instead of hitting it, you apply slow, steady pressure. It's very elaborate, and not very many people can do it.
I was going to say, have you ever tried to do this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's not easy.
And how long did it take you to make one spearhead?
Oh, I never got that far.
It's
just practice like anything else. When I was working as an archaeologist when I first started out, you know, I could make a scraping tool or something like that.
So then could you tell, like if you see paintings today, mm-hmm. and you can say, that comes from this school of painting, that school, could you begin to detect special technicians? And how did they pass it on? And were there changes? It's fascinating to think.
Yeah,
you
could
look at this and say, this comes from, you know, some fellow 11,000
years ago.
There may
have been a Rembrandt of point making.
Quite likely. Yeah. People who specialize in this, in archaeology, think that they can see, like in a, let's say you find a bison kill, you know, where a bunch of buffalo were killed, and you find some of these spear points. Some of the people who work with the technology think that they can identify, okay, these points were made by person A and uh-huh. these points were made by person B by very carefully looking at the way the flaking is what we call it, the flaking pattern. You can never know that, right? We can't know for sure, but based on their people's work with their own personal experiences with making artifacts, think they can see individuals. Now, tracing them through across, say, the Great Plains or through time, I don't know that anybody's tried that. That would be a real interesting test to see if
the other question that would come up, and when you read about this, these men were out there hunting all the time, so maybe the women were making them back
in
the camp.
Yeah, that point has been raised. But again, it's something you can never know.
Yeah.
How does a little 6-inch spearhead kill a bison or something?
I mean,
did you just bleed them to death slowly?
Probably.
You had to chase them for miles across until they just bled to death and collapsed.
I remember reading about something like that, and they, first of all, it took a lot of people. It wasn't like one guy hunting, and they would sort of try to get in a place where it was cornered,
uh-huh.
so it couldn't run.
So there's a lot of manpower involved in the final death.
Probably whole groups, you know, everybody involved.
I mean, the other thing
like
to remember was...
Like the forzados in the bullfighting in yeah. Spain.
Back in those days, they didn't have horses. They were all on foot.
Well, I was visiting a project in Montana last summer, and these were very late prehistoric, like just prior to European contact, bison jumps, where they were running bison off of cliffs. And that was very common. They have to go with the archaeological record there. They have historic documentation of how this was done because they were still doing this into the 1800s. And it involved everybody, you know, men, women, children, everyone got out there. And one of the interesting things about it archaeologically is it probably involved different groups of people, like different camps or tribes, who knows. But it's not just like a family, a bunch of people getting together. And so there's all kinds of social...
Cooperation.
Exactly, social implications that you can make when you find, say, a pile of 100 dead bison 10,000 years old and a lot of these spear points in the bone bed. You know, that means there were probably a bunch of people.
How did they preserve the meat? Or did they just eat it in one big meal and that was it?
Probably, maybe dry it. Depends on the time
of year. Is that well understood, in fact?
No, because... What we can do, the bison, the population of the bone bed, let's say you have 100 bison. One of the things you could tell the people who study bison or animals in these sites can figure out what time of year because of the way the teeth are erupting. And if there are juvenile animals, they know that the time of year that modern bison give birth. And so then they assume that that's what's going on in the
past. What about smoking the meat? I know later the people probably. Were smoking it. Maybe they did know 10,000 years ago how
to smoke.
Or
just drying it, you know, like beef jerky, that sort of
and
thing.
And then salting it too, perhaps.
Right. Salting, if it's in the winter, if it's a winter kill or cool season time of the year. There's some evidence maybe putting it in water because they found what appear to be caches, in other words, a lot of bones in pits next to a river. To keep it cool, or maybe they just they ate it as fast as they could. You never know. And some of these the kill sites, you whatever number of bison run off the cliff is what you've got. And there's evidence that they would butcher the animals on the top of the pile, and then the rest were left because when they excavate these things, they'll find completely articulated. You know, they're all together down deep because it couldn't get to them.
So it was a pretty inefficient way to do this.
Probably. Oh yeah, very inefficient. But you know, if you're starving to death,
Well, in fact, just the other day, I was listening to, I think it was the BBC. They just uncovered in the Yemen some arrowheads, which they claim were sort of so anachronistic that it's sort of redeveloping the thought of the migration of human species completely out of Africa.
Yeah, 10,000 years earlier, the people were migrating from Africa, according to these things.
Yeah, but in a totally different direction, through the desert as opposed to up through the Mediterranean and then hiking it out east. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, still,
we don't
these
know
artifacts.
As much as we think we do. And one of the questions that I want to ask you is, you know, a few years ago there was this question about this 10,000-year-old white guy that was found up in Washington.
Oh, right.
You know that?
Oh, yeah.
Whatever happened to that? I mean... Well, one of the big problems, I think they were saying.
Well, the term that was used was Caucasoid.
Caucasoid.
And what was misunderstood in the press, and probably by a lot of people, is that in physical anthropology, that's an old term, Caucasoid, that didn't mean white people. It had a reference to a particular sort of skeletal morphology, typical of originally way back in the early days of physical anthropology. It was linked to people in obviously the Caucasus area, but it was completely misrepresented as meaning white people, and that's simply not that was not the intention. It was really a poor choice of words.
So then the whole issue was sort of a red herring. It can be expected to find the odd Caucasoid remnant.
Well, within the population at that time, there's variation like there is today.
Well, these people are coming from Western Siberia, so it would be natural there might be a few Caucasians there too.
But Caucasoid is not the same as Caucasian.
He just explained that, Russell. You weren't paying attention. Okay, so we've muddied the waters even further during the last 3 minutes.
Okay, another question I have, and you were talking about soil, was reading a story about the Aztecs coming out of Lake Texcoco and invading the Maya and all that. And I read a paper said that they had polluted Lake Texcoco. They had too many metals, whatever they were growing there was algae and so on, and they had a problem, a food problem. That's why they went out. And that was through the analysis of the muds and things like that.
Yes, that's... I don't know the details of the archaeology down there, but I do know that there's quite a bit of evidence for soil erosion. You get more people on the landscape, particularly with agriculture. One of the things that goes along with agriculture in most places, and you could see this in the prehistoric record, is soil erosion.
Or wearing it out before they knew about fertilizers.
Exactly.
And so on, right?
Overusing the soil, depleting it of nutrients, soil erosion. And so, you get people living on the landscape. They're getting rid of the trees. Their ground may be bare for part of the year and it rains. Soil erosion can be a kind of pollution. If you just dump too much sediment, too much eroded material into a lake, it could come along with it could be, excess amounts of algae. So it could be considered toxic in the sense that it's changing the character of the lake or the rivers. And
so they're not productive as they were.
Exactly. Yeah.
So from all these historical understandings, has that applied now to the way that we use our own land? I mean, I don't know how many thousands of tons per minute of soil are being washed down the Mississippi. But
you have a dead zone at the mouth.
That's right. The phosphates and lack of
oxygen. Yeah, too many, which actually helps the oil spill clean up.
So what have we learned? Or you probably don't even know. I mean, do you understand how we
have
learned?
Or are there examples you worked on from the past where you saw that?
Most of the archaeological work I've been involved in is pre-agriculture. But I've been on a lot of sites and excavations and seen sites where you can see for example, early agriculture in the Southwest, one of the problems you have there is salinization of the soil, where people are adding irrigation water to the soil. And what happens is, because it's so dry, like exactly around here, you can see the same thing around here, is a lot of the salts that are in the water that would normally be flushed through the soil in a wetter environment, they get concentrated right in the growing zone because it's so dry. And there's evidence of a number of places in the Southwest where fields were abandoned, probably because the soils were being polluted with salt, natural pollutants, but it's because of artificial activity. So, you can see this going back. The very earliest agriculture in the Old World in Europe, coming out of the Tigris and Euphrates area, you could see the effects of soil erosion as agriculture spread throughout Europe. You also see very intense soil erosion spreading throughout Europe.
Which leads to the understanding that the periodic flooding is actually a very valuable tool for desalination of fertile plains.
Right, exactly.
I mean, I'd like to flood my garden because, I mean, it's a locked system. I have underground sprinkler, but you can see the salt build up over 10, 15
exactly.
years. I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah, because it's so dry here, it's been concentrated.
And you mentioned before that you studied a lake early in your career there. Did you find any evidence that the lake had changed because people were there?
No. The lake deposits we were dealing with are way before any sort of agriculture, human modification of the landscape. The people are basically hunting animals and probably making use of plants. So this, again, is going back about 10,000 years. This is around Lubbock. On the Great Plains, in that part of the Great Plains, there wasn't much in the way of agriculture. They were pretty much hunting and gathering peoples, hunting bison, making use of whatever plants were going on. So you have to go to other places. In that particular part of Texas, for example, you don't see much human impact on the landscape, at least that we can detect.
We want to have you back next week then to talk about some other areas, some specific areas. I know you work in Mexico as mm-hmm. well as in the United States.
Sure.
And it would be interesting to sort of go into detail about some of your locations.
Okay.
And so we'll be back next week with another Science Studio with Vance Holliday from the University of Arizona. And thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And we will be back, as I just said, next week with a second edition of the Vance Holliday program on Science Studio. Bye-bye. ¶¶